Arrests in Fairbanks on allegations of threats to kill a federal judge. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, reactions to the threat of a tsunami after the earthquake in Japan.
So we were pretty much on full alert at that point. We were up and out of bed and, you know, kind of getting ready to flee if we needed to flee.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Alaska State Troopers, Fairbanks Police, and federal law enforcement officials have arrested five people in the Fairbanks area for allegedly planning to kidnap and possibly kill troopers and a federal judge. According to a statement issued by troopers, the five were charged with conspiring to commit murder, kidnapping, arson, along with weapons misconduct, hindering prosecution, and tampering with evidence. Those arrested are Francis Schaefer Cox, Lonnie Vernon, Karen Vernon, Coleman Barney, and Michael Anderson. U.S. Attorney Karen Loeffler said Lonnie Vernon was charged with threatening to kill federal judge Ralph Beislein. The arrests took place yesterday and were completed by evening. 55-year-old Vernon, who is accused of evading income tax obligations, pleaded not guilty today to federal charges of threatening the judge overseeing the case. Vernon faces a two-count federal indictment that claims he threatened to murder U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beislein in an attempt to intimidate and interfere with the judge in retaliation for Beislein issuing rulings in a civil tax case. Vernon also faces state charges, as does a more high-profile defendant, 26-year-old Francis Schaefer Cox, a leader in a militia movement. State troopers say Cox, Vernon, and the three others collectively face conspiracy, weapons, and evidence tampering charges. They are to be arraigned today in state court. Authorities say the group is involved with the Sovereign Citizen Movement. The FBI describes the Sovereign Citizen Movement as a domestic terrorism group. Japan is currently recovering from a major earthquake that has left hundreds dead. Alaska's coastal communities braced themselves for a resulting tsunami last night, but the impact in the state appears to be minimal. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
Communities across the Aleutian Chain in coastal Alaska spent the night preparing for the impacts of a tsunami caused by an 8.9 magnitude earthquake off the coast of Japan. The earthquake hit just before 9 p.m. Alaska time, and by 11 p.m., tsunami warnings were in effect across the state's Pacific coastline. The tsunami first hit the Aleutian Islands of Attu and Shemya at around midnight, causing area waters to swell up to 5 feet. In Unalaska, the water level rose about 18 inches just after 2 in the morning. Sitka experienced small waves from 4 in the morning to 7 o'clock. So far, no injuries or damage have been reported in Alaska. In Unalaska, some residents packed their bags in preparation to move to higher ground, while others slept through the whole affair. Sonia Streetmatter says she spent most of the night listening for alerts and communicating with friends.
You know, at first we weren't very concerned, and then we started to kind of get a little bit nervous. I get the texts from public safety about the warnings and alerts and things like that. And so the first one wasn't very troubling. And then the second one, we were trying to go back to sleep. And, you know, the second one was, you know, a little bit more urgent. So we kind of got up at that point and, you know, we packed bags and, you know, kind of got the kids up and got them dressed and everything. And so we were pretty much on full alert at that point. We were up and out of bed and, you know, kind of getting ready to flee if we needed to flee.
While Unalaska's emergency sirens never sounded, city manager Chris Laddick says that an evacuation was a serious possibility at one point.
We were really close last night.
Throughout the day, the region remained under tsunami advisory. In a press conference, federal officials warned that the initial effects of a tsunami are not necessarily the most severe, and that emergency alerts should continue to be heeded, especially given the magnitude of this earthquake. David Applegate from the U.S. Geological Survey describes it as one of the strongest in recorded history.
When you're looking at a nearly magnitude 9 earthquake like this, we're talking about something that's roughly 1,000 times more energy released than a magnitude 7 like the one that devastated Port-au-Prince. And you're putting that into the water column, and it's transmitting at, of course, airline speeds as it moves across the entire Pacific Basin.
So far, the tsunami's greatest impact has been on the California coast. In Crescent City Harbor, damage was done to the docks, and one missing person is feared dead. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Alaska Marine Highway System sent 2 ferries out to sea this morning to avoid high waves expected from the earthquake in Japan. The small ferry Lituya left its dock in Metlakatla in southern southeast, and the fast ferry Shiniga headed out from the Cordova terminal into Prince William Sound. Marine Highway Chief Captain Mike Newsell says the small ferries were in what was considered to be high-threat areas.
Ship in open water, tsunami, not a big deal. Ship tied to the pier when the tsunami can be catastrophic. So 2 of our smaller vessels got them underway as a precaution.
The ships were back in port in time for their scheduled morning sailings. The only other ferry impact was on the Kennecott. Its Bellingham, Washington arrival was delayed 1.5 hours because the port was closed, also as a precaution. No tsunami damage was reported at any marine highway terminal. The West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center says waves that did reach ferry ports were less than 1 foot tall. The exception was 1.3 feet at Dutch Harbor. Airfields were also impacted by the quake. Sitka's Rocky Gutierrez Airport shut down power for a few hours due to concerns that waves might hit generators. One scheduled flight was delayed 1 hour, and 3 passenger jets were diverted to Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport to avoid landing in Japan. A federal appeals court panel has ordered a new corruption trial for former state representative Vic Coring because federal prosecutors failed to share favorable evidence with his defense attorney. This is the same issue that led a judge to reverse the conviction of U.S. Senator Ted Stevens and involves the same prosecution team and how they handled key witness Bill Allen. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
The appeals court panel disagreed with trial court Judge John Sedgwick about whether the evidence not shared with Vic Coring would have made a difference in the trial. Vico Incorporated owner Bill Allen expected friendly treatment for the oil companies from Coring and repeatedly gave him money. Some of this was caught on recordings, like this one made by the FBI in Allen's room in the Baranoff Hotel during the 2006 legislative session. Coring tells Allen that he owes money on his credit card and can't pay it. He says it would be politically embarrassing to him if it got out that bill collectors were after him, and he just didn't have the money. It is right on camera when Allen hands Coring a fistful of what he said were $100 bills. What the jury did not know was that Bill Allen was under investigation for his relations with underage girls, and this could have been used to cast doubt on Allen's testimony about the money he gave Coring and why he gave it, says the 3-judge appeals court panel in its ruling. There was other evidence as well, Allen's memory problems, and the kind of favorable treatment he got from prosecutors in exchange for his cooperating and giving evidence. As it turned out, the jury did not convict Coring of extortion, trying to squeeze money from Allen, so Judge Sedgwick concluded that whether Allen lied about the $17,000 was not material. But the appeals panel didn't see it that way. They say Coring was prejudiced by the suppression. It's not known whether a new trial will actually happen. Coring has been out of prison since June of 2009. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
President Obama rebuffed Republican criticism today that his administration is not doing enough to encourage oil development.
So any notion that my administration has shut down oil production might make for a good political soundbite, but it doesn't match up with reality. We are encouraging offshore exploration and production. We're just doing it responsibly.
With the cost of gasoline at the pump lurching higher because of instability in the Middle East, Republicans and the Alaska congressional delegation are pushing the Obama administration to expand domestic oil production. But President Obama says his team is boosting production of oil and gas, and at a White House press conference today, he pointed to new numbers that show American oil production has reached its highest level in 7 years.
And we're working with industry to explore new frontiers of production, safety measures, and containment technology. We're looking at potential new development in Alaska, both onshore and offshore.
The president says, however, that even if new wells are drilled tomorrow, that oil won't be available overnight. He's pushing for cutting dependence on fossil fuels, both through efficiency and new technologies. Obama repeated his call for a long-term, comprehensive energy strategy.
The bottom line is this. We've been having this conversation for nearly four decades now. Every few years, gas prices go up, politicians pull out the same old political playbook, and then nothing changes. And when prices go back down, we slip back into a trance, and then when prices go up, suddenly we're shocked. I think the American people are tired of that. I think they're tired of talk.
The president called for bipartisan efforts on energy. Alaska's delegation wants to see the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge open to development and wants to see exploration wells drilled off Alaska's coasts. They say the Obama administration is dragging its feet with offshore environmental permits, which has cost the oil company Shell time and money as it tries to move forward on drilling plans. Shell canceled its Arctic development plans for this summer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, women who were instrumental in the lead-up to the Native Land Claims Act.
You do not keep your land as an absentee landlord. You don't keep your land by using it as collateral.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Alaska's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate was 7.7% in January, the lowest level in more than a year and a half. January's rate dropped 0.2% from December, according to the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development. December's rate was revised down from the preliminary estimate of 8.1 to 7.9. It was also the 27th consecutive month Alaska's unemployment rate has been below the national average, which was 9% in January. But state economist Neil Fried says the difference between the two rates will narrow if the national economy continues its recovery.
It's all up to not what happens here so much, but how fast the American job market recovers. If it begins to recover very rapidly, then it could conceivably begin to occur by the end of this year. Otherwise, it may take until next year.
The education and healthcare sectors continue to show strong growth in Alaska, up about 1,900 jobs since January 2010. Leisure and hospitality, including tourism, had the strongest growth from last year, gaining about 2,200 jobs. Oil and gas was relatively flat, with about 500 new jobs over the course of last year. But Fried cautions the Labor Department's new method of calculating employment could be skewing the numbers.
It's a new methodology that the federal government came up with. And the problem with it is that maybe for bigger states it works out pretty well. But it for a little state like Alaska, that where we have so much seasonality, this method has really made a lot more volatility in these numbers than we think really exist.
Juneau's unemployment rate was among the lowest in the state in January at 6%. The lowest rate was in the North Slope Borough, which had a 4.2% unemployment rate. Skagway had the highest at 29.9%. Anchorage's unemployment rate was 6.5%. The leaders of the 2011 Iditarod are on the Yukon. Sebastian Schnula is currently leading mushers in the Iditarod, checking into Grayling at 10:48 this morning, with Hans Gott hot on his trail, checking in only 19 minutes later. Neither has taken their eight-hour break yet. After resting for 8 hours, Hugh Neff, John Baker, Lance Mackey, Ray Reddington Jr., and Martin Boozer have left Anvik and are en route to Grayling. Robert Bunsen has also made it through Anvik and is on his way to Grayling, but has not yet taken his eight-hour stop. Sonny Lindner and Dallas Seavey have also departed Anvik after taking their eight-hour break. Hugh Neff has yet to win a sled dog race, though he's been a strong contender many times. So today's events have a special meaning for him. APRN's trail reporter Tim Bodoni has more.
Usually it's the bell atop Anvik's Episcopal Church that signals the arrival of the first musher into this lower Yukon River community. But this year, the local dogs bark their greetings to the visiting dog team driven by Hugh Neff. Well aware of the prize he had just won, an 8-course gourmet meal cooked on portable camp stoves inside the checkpoint, Neff said what was on his mind, or his stomach.
Me hungry.
He finished signing in and then gave his unique go command to scoot his 12 dogs down to their resting place where they'd spend the next 8 hours.
All right.
Inside, as he tore into his sourdough French toast with blackberry-infused maple syrup, Neff reflected on what he had just accomplished.
Even though people know who I am and I've done a lot of races, I've never actually won anything in a dog mushing race before. I've been given an award, Challenge of the North Award in the Quest, but I've never actually won anything. So to actually accomplish something like that with the dogs is a good feeling. And that's why I think Anvik will always have a special place in my heart, just because this is where it happened first.
The leaderboard of the 2011 Iditarod shifted drastically along the desolate 55-mile stretch of trail from the ghost town of Iditarod to Shagaluk. With the previous race leader Martin Boozer still resting back at Iditarod, Sebastian Schnula decided to forego the checkpoint and press ahead last night. Neff pursued, followed by Boozer, John Baker, Hans Gott, Lance Mackey, and Ray Reddington Jr. Schnula stopped, and Neff took the lead. Meanwhile, Boozer, who had been setting a remarkably fast pace, was slowing down and getting past. Boozer explained at Anvik that it wasn't the dog's fault, but his. He fell asleep a few times on the runners and even fell off the sled. At Anvik, his position had slipped from first to fifth. But with a firm trail on the Yukon lying ahead, Boozer was happy to become a pursuer.
If the river stays like that, it's going to be awesome to have a good trail like that and have maybe some teams in front. I'm the slow team now.
The team of four-time defending champion Lance Mackey continues to dwindle. He arrived at Anvik with only 9 of his original 16 dogs, the smallest team still in the race at that time. Only 2 of those dogs are Iditarod veterans, including the experienced lead dog Rev, who Mackey says he wants to protect and conserve in case he really needs a solid leader down the trail. Assessing his chances from here on out, Mackey insists that he might be down, but he's not out.
And down on numbers, I'm not down. It's hard not to be a little bit discouraged and frustrated even a little bit, because I know how it can be and how perfect it can be. You know, it's a dog race and anything can happen.
As Neff got ready to leave Anvik under the bright Friday afternoon sun, the teams of Sebastian Schnula and Hans Gott were further down the trail, resting at Grayling. It appears that a game of leapfrog the leader is poised to occur up the Yukon. But Neff said that he doesn't care where his team sits on the ranking sheet, at least not yet.
Take my time. I totally don't care about position or whatever. If people want to come flying by me, I love to follow other teams. Until the end, of course. No hurries, no worries.
So long as it remains unseasonably warm, Neff says that he wants to get back on a run schedule that has him doing most of his traveling at night. But with his mandatory 8-hour layover done at Anvik and the sun beating down, it was time to go.
All right, Eddie. All right, let's go. All right.
Reporting from the Iditarod Trail at Anvik, this is Tim Bodoni.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
An internationally recognized expert on environmental links to cancer and human health will be speaking in Anchorage Sunday evening. Dr. Sandra Steingraber will be discussing her newest book called Raising Elijah, Protecting Our Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Steingraber says she wrote this book, titled after her second child, because she says environmental crisis threatens two fundamental parental duties, protecting your child from harm and planning for their future. Steingraber says it's not possible to keep your children safe when toxins are in their bodies.
Which we as parents are powerless to keep out of the bodies of our children. Children grow so rapidly, which is to say that their bodies are being assembled from molecules of air, food, and water in their environments. And so whatever toxic chemicals is in the air, food, and water becomes the bodies of our children. Providing for their future requires a stable climate, and that too is being threatened by another branch of the ecological crisis.
She says both share a common cause, what she calls a ruinous dependence on fossil fuel. Steingraber's previous books include Living Downstream, an ecologist's personal investigation of cancer and the environment. She herself is a cancer survivor. Sunday's lecture will be at the LUSAC Library, starting with a reception at 6:30 p.m. The ad hoc ANCSA at 40 committee recently hosted its third panel on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. This one features some of the women behind the claims movement. The four panelists represented the people in meetings in Alaska and in Washington, D.C. during the struggle for ANCSA. They've served in a number of other leadership roles in the legislature, as staff to a U.S. senator, as a school board, tribal council, and borough assembly members, and on the boards of Alaska Native regional nonprofit and for-profit organizations. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
In Nupiak, Brenda Itta Lee says she grew up in Barrow on the North Slope in the days when there was no electricity, no television, no telephone, and no cars. Itta Lee says the news in 1968 that oil had been discovered at Prudhoe Bay was overwhelming.
We did not know the oil industry. It seemed that the state government and the federal government, as well as the oil industry, it seemed that they had very little regard for us, and yet we had lived there, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, and many of our people were gripped with fear.
In Nupiak, Frances Ann Degnan of Unalakleet on the coast of central western Alaska says before ANCSA, Alaska Natives experienced poverty and isolation and relied heavily on subsistence, a concept they had to share with congressional members from very different backgrounds.
Each one of us being there, everyone brought to the table their experiences in their culture, in their way of life, in us being there and able to articulate it, but we had the same story, the very same story. We all come from Native claimed areas that belong to tribes.
Athabascan Agnes Brown was born and raised in Tyonik on the Upper Cook Inlet in south central Alaska. She says the land claims movement was a struggle, but they persevered.
We took up collections for plane fares. I was a young mother during those early days, and I would go and pick up people at the airport even if I had never met them before. Got them to where they had to go, and sometimes even took them to my house for lunch. And that's the way we did it. Mm-hmm. But No, I don't think that there was necessarily any sense of, oh, this is too much work and we're going to give up.
After ANCSA was signed into law, these women moved into positions of leadership within the village and regional for-profit corporations ANCSA created. Clinkett Marlene Johnson of HUNA served on the board of the Southeast Alaska Native Regional Corporation, Sea Alaska. She says she stepped aside after 25 years so young people could move into leadership positions.
We've got several young attorneys, we've got doctors. I mean, we've got some educated young people on that board now, and I'm so proud of what I see, that they don't need me, you know. I need them now, and so I just really tickled, and I hope that the young people that are here realize that we, us old folks, are going to be relying on you to keep the corporations going, because we are land-based. It isn't the money. It's the land.
Degnan says upcoming leaders are responsible for maintaining the corporate land base for future generations.
You do not keep your land as an absentee landlord. You don't keep your land by using it as collateral. You have that land base is your wealth. It's a charge. The ancestors kept that charge. We kept that charge to the best we can, and here we are, we're still whole. You have that charge. Keep it whole.
The ANCSA at 40 committee plans to host another panel in April. In Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The House Judiciary Committee today passed a crime bill designed to address electronic stalking and expand the legal protections for minors. The bill was proposed by Governor Sean Parnell as a way to expand punishments for distributing child pornography and criminalize stalking using technology like global positioning systems or keystroke trackers. The bill also allows the Attorney General to subpoena internet service providers for information relating to prosecutions. The bill now heads to the House Finance Committee. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Onalaska, Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Steve Heimel and Josh Edge from Anchorage, and Tim Bodoni on the Iditarod Trail. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ansep.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.